It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, as college students head back to campus, we'll find out about new cultural immersion day trips being offered at UW-Green Bay. First, the state legislature's budget committee met yesterday to talk about education funding in Wisconsin. Laurel White is WPR's Capitol reporter, and she joins us from the state capitol to share the details of yesterday's meeting. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Governor Walker called for a $684 million spending increase for schools in the state budget. What did lawmakers decide on that number yesterday?
So the governor had proposed the $648 million increase. I think he did the little number flip there.
Yes, thank you.
That has happened to me many a time. So yeah, he proposed $648 million, and lawmakers came in about $10 million less than that. The budget committee approved $639 million yesterday.
And what do you think what did they say about the difference? Not a huge difference, but a difference nonetheless.
Yeah, so about the $10 million difference there can be pinned to a lot of small changes, but the two biggest ones were reducing funding for sparsity aid, and that's aid that goes to rural school districts in Wisconsin, districts that have fewer than 10 students per square mile, for example. So the governor had proposed more funding for those districts in Wisconsin. The budget committee didn't approve as much as he had called for. And the budget committee also reduced the governor's proposal for some performance funding for schools in Milwaukee. Schools that were rated significantly exceeds expectations or exceeds expectations were supposed to get some money in this budget, but lawmakers zeroed that out and are just sending money to schools that fail to meet expectations. So just kind of a little rearranging there.
And in terms of how much school districts can spend per student, what do we know about that?
So they approved what the governor had proposed in that instance. So the governor had called for a $200 per pupil spending increase each year over the next 2 years. And lawmakers went along with that proposal to increase student spending each year in the budget.
And what did the budget committee decide when it comes to the amount schools can tax local residents for education funding?
So this part is kind of wonky for individuals who aren't familiar with how schools are funded in Wisconsin and things called levy limits or revenue limits. So basically, in as simple of terms as I can try to explain it, there are caps that the state puts on local governments for the amount of property tax increases they can do to pay for schools. And right now, that state revenue limit is $9,100 a year for low-spending districts. So what this new budget would do would lift that kind of cap, it is a cap, from $9,100 to $9,300 in 2017 and $9,400 in 2018, and actually put stair steps in beyond this next biennial budget all the way to the year 2022, when that levy limit would be $9,800.
And we have a little bit of audio from yesterday. Here's a clip of Republican Representative John Nygren from Marinette, who's co-chair of the Budget Committee. And here he is talking about increasing the so-called levy limit.
We need to be able to give our schools the same opportunity and our kids the same opportunity, regardless of their zip codes.
Laurel, can you tell us a little bit about the context of that quote?
Yeah, so he was just talking about how some, you know, those lower spending districts, those districts that are, you know, being held down by that $9,100 cap, would be able to spend more money, would be able to infuse more money into the classroom if that state imposed limit was lifted. So he says, you know, higher spending districts are able to get around that, but the lower spending districts that have to obey this cap don't have the same opportunity as some of the wealthier parts of the state. So essentially what Representative Nygren is saying there is that lifting these levy limits creates more parity between school districts in Wisconsin, regardless of where you're located in the state and maybe the economic circumstances of the community.
We're talking to Laurel White right now, WPR State Capitol reporter, and she's catching us up on the legislature's budget committee meeting on education that took place yesterday. And Laurel, the budget committee also talked about changes to the eligibility for Wisconsin's statewide private school voucher program. What did they decide there?
So what they did there was they increased the number of people who are eligible to get vouchers to attend private schools in Wisconsin. So right now, the eligibility requirement for a family income to get a voucher is 185% of the federal poverty level. And that's about $45,000 a year for a family of four. And what the State Budget Committee approved yesterday is increasing that cap from 185% of the federal poverty level to 220% of the federal poverty level. So that would be about $54,000 a year for a family of four.
And what do we know about how many students would be included given that change?
So according to the state's nonpartisan budget office, which releases estimates and evaluates the lawmakers' various budget proposals, they say that that increased cap will accommodate about 550 additional students across the state that could participate in that voucher program.
And the shift for voucher schools was not something that was without controversy. Here's a little bit from Democratic Representative Katrina Shanklin from Stevens Point, and she's arguing here against the eligibility increase.
You keep on expanding vouchers, you're taking money directly out of our public school children's opportunities. And that's a big deal. That's something that I don't support, and that's why I think this motion is far out of line with Wisconsin values.
So some strong words there from Representative Shanklin. Who else had things to say about that topic?
So on the other side of the argument, there were several Republican lawmakers arguing that increasing the voucher program in Wisconsin just provides more opportunities for parents to choose a different school for their child, to send them where they want them to go to school. And an interesting argument came from Representative Dale Coinga, who is a Republican from Brookfield. And he talked about how he has a friend who works in an Orthodox Jewish school in Milwaukee, and how he has heard from some parents who want to send their child to this Orthodox Jewish school, but don't have the finances to do so.
And here's Representative Coinga.
And they can't send their kids to a culture and a tradition and a religion that they hold value to their background if we don't have this program. And so, in summary, I think that having diversity in our schools, also by expanding the school choice to a higher dollar amount, is important to our kids' interaction of the social fabric of our community.
And anything else from that discussion, Laurel, that stuck out to you yesterday?
Well, it really was one of the more, I don't want to say dramatic, but there was definitely conflict over the voucher expansion during yesterday's committee hearing. I mean, there was some discussion about raising that income cap from all the way, you know, from 185% where it is now to 300%. So some, particularly Republicans on the budget committee, said that eligibility hasn't been widened enough for vouchers. And then we had the Democrats, including Representative Shanklin, who we heard from just a minute ago, saying that any more money that goes to the voucher program is essentially being taken from public schools in Wisconsin, and they're not comfortable with that.
So they talked about K through 12 education in Wisconsin yesterday, and the budget committee also talked about the UW system and some building projects there. What's the latest?
So there were a number of different building projects that were funded during the budget committee meeting yesterday. They took up the building projects before they moved on to K-12 spending. So we found out that the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, Madison, Parkside, Platteville, and River Falls all got new projects. Eau Claire got $19 million for an addition and a renovation at Governor's Hall on campus. UW-Madison got $23 million for utility repairs at Bascom Hill, and then some other projects kind of here and there scattered around the state. But the big kind of marquee building project that was approved yesterday was $55 million for a new engineering building at the UW-Platteville that's going to be called Sesquicentennial Hall.
And the UW-Platteville, at least according to what I'm hearing from the meeting yesterday, has a big engineering program, and it sounds as though some legislators feel that it needs more attention.
Yeah, that's right. So before the committee meeting yesterday, reporters were talking to one of the co-chairs of the budget committee, Senator Alberta Darling, who's from River Hills, and she was pointing out how UW-Platteville is the flagship engineering program in the state of Wisconsin, and she really thinks that it deserves some more attention. And she says that this new building will help the campus produce about 800 more engineers per year, and that'll help address a shortage of engineers in Wisconsin.
And so finally, Laurel, some other really big Wisconsin news today. Department of Natural Resources Secretary Kathy Stepp announced that she's leaving her post at the DNR and she's taking a job with the EPA under the Trump administration. What do we know about that developing story?
So we just found this out this morning that Secretary Kathy Stepp is leaving Wisconsin. She has been the DNR secretary since 2011. So this is a big change for the department. She's been around for quite a while, moving on to the EPA. What we know right now is that her deputy secretary, Kurt Thiede, is going to step in and serve as an interim secretary effective on August 31st.
And what did Stepp have to say about why she decided to make that move?
Well, folks are kind of framing this as just a new opportunity for her, obviously a different agency, to move on to a national level working for the EPA and having an impact and different responsibilities and a regional impact there where she's working, of course, outside in the region more than just the state of Wisconsin.
Laurel, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you next time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, and she was with us there to catch us up on the legislature's Budget Committee meeting on education. Coming up, we'll learn about new cultural immersion day trips for students at UW-Green Bay. Stay with us here on Central Time. College students are moving back to campus and gearing up for another school year. At the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, students have the option of attending a free cultural immersion day trip. The first one is this Sunday at the Hmong Labor Day Festival in Green Bay. Milo Lee is the Interim Diversity Director for the American Intercultural Center at UW-Green Bay, and she joins us now to talk about these cultural immersion day trips. Mai, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. Nyezhong. It's an honor to be here.
Well, this is the first time, it sounds like, that UW-Green Bay is doing these cultural immersion day trips. What made the university decide to create them, to start this up?
Yeah, we're really excited to offer our UW-Green Bay students these cultural immersion day trips. It really came from actually our students expressing that they just wanted more immersion with what was domestically available for them instead of going into international countries.
And so when we talk about what's available in terms of immersion, what kinds of things were you looking at when you decided to put this schedule together of different trips?
Well, we are really lucky that in the state of Wisconsin, it literally is in our backyard. So what we were looking for was just availability with dates. Our students moved back on campus on Tuesday, September 5th, and so we didn't want to overwhelm them and compete with their academics. So we looked for what was being available within the first 3 weeks of campus or the first day of school, and then also what was within our backyard within the city of Green Bay.
And as we mentioned, this Sunday is the Hmong Labor Day Festival. What else is on the docket?
Yeah, after the Hmong Labor Day Festival, we have the Latino Fest celebration in the city of Appleton, which is about a 35-minute bus ride from our campus. And then on Sunday, September 10th, we'll be taking a large group of students to Indian Summer Festival in Milwaukee on the Summer Grounds Fest.
And what do you think the students were looking for in, you know, in a little more depth when they were looking for cultural immersion?
Well, I think one of the first things is, particularly if you don't identify with these hyphenated American or groups, it's safety in numbers, and then also it being a little bit more organized. With the Hmong Labor Day Festival, there's going to be professionals there and also our American students who identify as Hmong themselves to kind of have a liaison within that culture to be able to explain cultural activities, ethnic experiences, and the traditional foods that students may be trying.
Is there a large interest so far? Do you have big enrollment for these trips?
Well, on any campus, anything free always has large interest. Because this is our first time that we're putting all three at the same time, we believe that our Sunday one is going to be very large attended because school is not in session yet. Saturday, September 9th, we are competing also with a free concert at Lambeau Field. So we're going to, hopefully those numbers will be high. But it looks like the Indian Summer Festival seems to be very highly or students to be really interested in that. I think it could be because a lot of it is in the Milwaukee's famous Summer Ground Festival grounds.
And like you said, when we think about cultural immersion, a lot of times it seems like that means international travel, getting on an airplane, going somewhere, living somewhere for a while. Do you feel as though these trips, which take place for a day, they do have a lot to offer in terms of exploring ideas about diversity and culture?
Yeah, one of the first things that we always demystify with our students is that culture, everyone has it, and that it is in your backyard, that it is in your classroom. So that's one of the first things that our department, the American Intercultural Center, educates on and really promotes. But then also is to create that bridge. These are just one-day festivals, but once you feel comfortable, once you learn, you will find out that there's year-long celebrations and there's year-long opportunities to immerse yourself within the Hmong community, within the Latino community, and then within the indigenous communities.
And will there be any kind of follow-up to keep that exploration going once the day festival is over?
Yeah, I was just going to say, on our campus, we always have semester-long opportunities available for students. One of the highlighted opportunities that we have is our cultural conversations, where it's facilitated with faculty, staff, and students, but it's an opportunity for our UW-Green Bay students to come and have casual, informal conversation on a variety of diversity and inclusion topics.
We're talking with Milo Lee right now from UW-Green Bay, talking about the university's first ever cultural immersion day trips for students. And Mai, what is the goal for students? What are you hoping they come away with after maybe going to one or two or three of these day trips?
Well, one of the first goals or the objectives for this trip is, A, to have our students recognize that culture is all around them. So that's one of the first ones. And then also to know that culture is also very domestic, that there's a lot of Americans who identify with different subcultures and very different race and ethnicity cultures. So that's one of the first objectives. But then also it really is to let our students know in the state of Wisconsin is that there is so many great opportunities to learn and to immerse themselves, to be better civic engaged individuals.
And so far, this is a session of three trips. It sounds like there's high enrollment for several of them. Do you think you want to expand this in the future and open more doors, for dialogue and other opportunities to travel?
I think the opportunity is always there. This is one of our bridge opportunities for them to then spring into our spring break trip where we take them to South Dakota and have them get immersed within the indigenous communities there. But then also to then see what it looks like with multicultural domestically. And then when they do their study abroad programs or if they choose to travel internationally, to be able to do a compare and contrast of this is what my country has to offer and this is what a different country has.
Are you planning for any moments afterwards where there might be questions that students have, or maybe there could be issues that come up, emotions that come up?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, sometimes when we open these kinds of possibilities, there can be difficult moments too, as well as, you know, growing moments.
Yeah, well, that is something that our campus is always prepared for. So as students become enlightened, it does challenge their concept of what culture is. A lot of our students, particularly first-year students, they get a lot of surface culture, so they see a lot of food and dress and music, but they might be immersing themselves into a little bit more deeper culture of learning about unspoken rules. They're a little bit more highly emotionally invested, and there's a lot of intense emotions as they learn about different concepts of self and the definition of different attitudes, problem solving, and just family in itself and kinship. So after each trip, there are resources that are given to students, and then also particularly different classes that will allow them to explore either what cultural immersion is or the different race and ethnicities that's available for them to take on campus.
Do you have any plans to work with other campuses and try to expand this?
You know, I think as a UW school, I think we have that responsibility to always be fiscally responsible with our money. UW Oshkosh is very close to us, so we are trying to collaborate to see if this is an opportunity for that. And also because we have St. Norbert College as a private school, to see if there's maybe a religious immersion day trip. And then, so that is something that we're planning for in spring, is our religious immersion day trips, to take different students to different faiths and to immerse themselves in that.
Oh, that sounds interesting. So when you take students to explore a different faith, do you do a little bit of legwork ahead of time and connect with the place you're going so that they can be prepared and there can be some kind of dialogue?
There is. I was just going to say, we're working on the legwork right now to take students to a Sikh temple that's close to our campus, and then to also take them to different synagogues and other religious affiliations. So there is a lot of legwork, particularly because we want the immersion to be very intentional. So there is a lot of preparation, and we do ask ourselves, when students volunteer themselves to immerse themselves, we want to make sure that there is good takeaways, and that whatever they choose to major in, that they become a more culturally diverse individual with who they are serving or what they're doing.
And do you have any thoughts for people who are listening now who aren't students, who might want to explore this same kind of opportunity here in the state of Wisconsin? How would you encourage them to do that based on what you've learned so far?
I think with the different regions that I've lived in the state of Wisconsin, there's always been, it seems like, a nonprofit multicultural organization that seems to be the leader in a lot of these events. So within the city of Appleton, I know there's Celebrate Diversity Fact Cities that takes the lead on that. Within the Green Bay area, there's the Multicultural Club that is a nonprofit that takes a lot of the promoting for that. I would say that it's all around, it's very intentional. And I think you just have to be very conscious of what you want to immerse yourself in and understand that you will be learning something new and that you have to be open to all these different cultural activities.
Well, Maya, I hope this Sunday is a wonderful experience for you. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Veronica. I appreciate the opportunity.
That was Milo Lee, Interim Diversity Director for the American Intercultural Center at UW-Green Bay, joining us to talk about the university's first ever cultural immersion day trips. You can find out more about that over on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll look at the growing number of shows and movies with girls starring as heroes. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is Central Time. The most well-known superheroes in American pop culture have mostly been men. When it comes to saving the day, female heroes have been few and far between. But turn on Netflix or consider the biggest blockbusters from the last few years, and it seems like girls and women are less likely to be the damsels in distress or less confident sidekicks. Now, more and more young girls are starring as action stars in mainstream movies and TV. Take a listen.
Saved the plane.
I would love to be upstairs watching TV or gossiping about boys or God, even studying. But I have to save the world again.
You didn't stand your ground. You didn't fight.
Because there was no chance of changing his mind.
This is Ares, and he's not going to allow a negotiation or a surrender. The millions of people you talked about, they will die.
Primrose Everdeen.
Prim! Prim! Stop! Stop! Volunteer! I volunteer! I volunteer as tribute!
That was Supergirl, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Wonder Woman, and, of course, The Hunger Games. Spring Duval joins us now to look at female superheroes in pop culture. She's an assistant professor of communication at Salem College. Spring, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So when did we start to see this shift of girls taking on these roles of the hero?
Well, it's interesting you played the clip of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, because in a way we were having some similar conversations in the 90s about these action star girls filling television and film, and a real emphasis on being more physically aggressive. But really, we've seen quite a bit of shift around the Hunger Games and in more recent years, as new franchises have developed these strong female characters, and then existing franchises like Star Wars have begun casting the women and girls as the lead protagonists.
And before that, I mean, you said there were some examples in the 90s. I remember Buffy, too. But it seemed like what was so unusual was because she was a girl. And that was sort of almost the whole conceit in the beginning before the show took off. But what was it like for women who were watching these shows, superhero movies and things like that? What were the roles for women then?
You mean in the 90s?
Yeah, in the 90s and leading up to where we are now.
Well, we saw these characters begin to take on more action roles, again, more physically aggressive. And yes, that was the hook, the sort of novelty that girls and women could be violent, which was typically associated with men and boys. But we did see that many of those characters, and Buffy included, they were still very much conforming to beauty norms. They tended to be slender, they tended to be white, they tended to dress almost like fashion plates, and so they were being aggressive, but they were doing it in high heels and full makeup, and so there was still a very limited depiction of them. And often we would also see them in those time periods relegated to the sort of sidekick role.
And what about today? Where do we see women taking off and taking on some of these new roles? We talked about a couple of them, but which ones are you especially impressed with?
Well, some of the ones I've been watching, as I said, and taking notice of, are the casting for the new Star Wars films, the latest Star Wars films. The new Wonder Woman film has been really challenging the idea of comic book heroes, which has been, in terms of summer blockbuster films, really dominated by the traditional male characters. And so for Wonder Woman to privilege that female character that has existed for quite some time and has been appealing to women and girls for a long time, now to have the big budget, high production value, large release has been very significant. And then we can look at a shift also in animation away from the typical princess to a more nuanced lead female character as well, when we look at Moana, for example, as a departure from the past princess movies that have been so typical.
Let's talk about Wonder Woman for a second. Do you consider that movie a win? You mentioned some good things about it, but on the other hand, she was also barely wearing anything, had a lot of makeup on, looked like a supermodel while she was doing it. So what is the message there?
I do think that it's a lot of pressure to put on one film to expect it to be completely without problem. So in many ways, it is going to conform to the genre in terms of the way that she looks, the character that she was in the comic books, the way that she's been depicted in films and her iconic outfit and those sorts of things. But there was quite a lot of emphasis in that film on female physical power, but also inner strength. There was quite a bit to the narrative about vulnerability, the power of love. And so in terms of building a more nuanced character, yes, she was somewhat stereotypical physically, but she does push boundaries for what we expect to see with a woman in a comic book film. And again, as the lead character rather than a sidekick or a side character, she opens up those doors for more nuanced and more complicated depictions, hopefully, in the future. So in terms of a win, as a film overall, it has its problems, but it certainly has been important as a boundary breaker in terms of not just Wonder Woman as a lead character in a major film, but in terms of featuring a female director as well.
We're talking right now to Spring Duval, assistant professor of communication at Salem College, looking at how girls are increasingly becoming the heroes in film and on TV. And what do you think it does for girls growing up and also for women to see women and in some cases girls in these leading types of roles, including action roles?
Well, for a very long time, girls have had a fairly limited visibility in media. And so to be able to see themselves in the hero role provides girls with more variety in their role models. They are able to look at these powerful women and girls and everything from Hunger Games, again, to Wonder Woman, and see someone that they might aspire to be like or that reflects them better than the typical boy hero might. We can see that this, just the visibility alone can be empowering, but then we can see how it might normalize the idea that, well, girls are complicated. They can be powerful. They can be very capable. It also validates that audiences have been really clamoring for these depictions for a very long time, and girls and women have quite a bit of purchasing power. So recognizing that this is what girls and women, many girls and women, are wanting to see, and then that they are, you know, sort of speaking with their money and buying movie tickets, watching television, and buying merchandise and so on.
And what about boys? What do you think boys growing up and men get when they see women in these roles? Does it help move the perception of what women can be?
I think it does. There is some evidence that children can be impacted by gender role stereotypes in media. And so while boys have been able to consume television and film and see representations of boys and men, much greater variety. They can see themselves in those depictions. They've typically been seeing girls as sidekicks or as sex objects, very sexy depictions. And so boys can see more nuanced girl characters as well, or see girls in those roles, and it can open up more possibility of seeing girls as, again, capable, as powerful in their own right, and not just existing to be looked at or to be sidekicks. And in fact, what's really interesting to me when I look at some programs, if we look at something like the television program Stranger Things, with the girl protagonist Eleven being a very powerful and nuanced character, but the cast of boys who are interacting with her are also fairly diverse and very interesting, very unique characters. And so I think sometimes if we see these girls cast in more diverse roles, we can also see that in the rest of the content reflected in more interesting roles for boys as well.
What did you think of the Ghostbusters remake starring all women in those roles that were typically, you know, those big name comedians, Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd? It seemed to me, busted another stereotype, which wasn't just the action part of it, but that women can be funny, that women are funny.
Yes, it's gotten so much attention lately, and it's really something that started, I think, to shift a little, where that question of whether women are funny is sort of being put to bed. But we saw that with Bridesmaids before Ghostbusters, and I think that what was interesting there was the backlash against Ghostbusters as having been one of those franchises that was so iconic and so important for people, and to then make that gender shift seemed to cause quite a controversy. But what it does is, again, it shows that women and girls can and should be in a diverse range of roles, from comedies to action to drama and so on, where we've seen in the past typically boys and men in a great variety and diversity of genres and productions. So there was sort of something that boys and men could look to regardless of their taste. But for women and girls to be able to also, again, have that choice of genre, of style, in those high production value films and television, really gives girls and women more options and validates that they are a powerful segment of the audience.
We're talking to Spring Duval right now, assistant professor of communication at Salem College, and we're looking at how girls are increasingly becoming the heroes in film and on TV. And we want to hear from you on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you see girls and women being cast as heroes in stories more often? Is there a girl hero that inspires you or inspires your kids? And do you look for more representation in heroes in books and TV and film? You can post on the Central Time Facebook page and see what other folks have to say while you're there. And we'll continue our conversation in a little bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing the conversation right now with Spring Duval, assistant professor of communication at Salem College, and we're talking about why TV and movies are increasingly casting girls as heroes. And you can tell us what you think on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you look for shows that have girls and women as the heroes? You can tell us why. Do you have a favorite, and do you think that girls and boys can learn from those kinds of stories? You can let us know what you're thinking over on the Central Time Facebook page. Let's go to our first caller now. We've got Paul joining us in Chippewa Falls. Paul, hi.
Hi. I wanted to call about how Ghostbusters, it had mostly women. It had an all-women cast, but if it was cast with all men for the second coming of, I don't think a lot of people would have gone to see it. And I was wondering if some, you know, producers promote these all-women casts to try to get more people to view them. Thank you.
Paul, thanks for that. And do you see anything, I don't know, he's not quite using this word, but anything gimmicky about using an all-woman cast in Ghostbusters and women in other places? Is it a novelty or is this a cultural shift?
Well, in a sense, we can see reboots and reboots of franchises as gimmicky, as trying to take a franchise with a built-in audience and make more money off of it. So that happens with many franchises, comic books franchises, Star Wars, Star Trek. And so when studios have these franchises, they own the rights to, or they own the script to, there's money to be made very often by revamping or rebooting those in some kind of fresh and appealing way. And so there is that motivation, that notion of, well, we could make more money off of this franchise if we reboot it or revamp it in some way, and then what's the novel way we could revamp it? But it's not gimmicky or just a novelty to try to appeal to women and girls as an audience segment, because, again, there is money to be made off of women and girls as audience members, as ticket purchasers. We know that movies that feature female protagonists and movies that are directed by women are very profitable. So recognizing that makes good business sense. It's not a one-off. It does seem to be a shift on the production side to recognize it makes business sense to produce these films and television shows and market to women and girls because they are such a powerful segment of the purchasing population. But then there is a cultural shift because we can situate this in a larger context where we're seeing discussions about diversity in Hollywood in terms of race and ethnicity, discussions about pay equity in Hollywood for women and girls. So all of these other broader aspects contribute to a greater diversity on screen.
Thanks a lot for that call, Paul. We appreciate it. And we're going to go next to Margaret in Madison. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to talk about Xena Warrior Princess.
Ah, yeah. What did you want to say?
I have two daughters that grew up in the 90s. And, boy, Xena Warrior Princess was a huge presence in our household. And it led to all kinds of creative play, creative costume making, making weapons, if you want to call them such, out of cardboard boxes, out of anything that they could find. My older daughter, she and her first boyfriend, I came home once and they were choreographing a stage fight in the backyard with lances. And what I liked most about that is that not so much that it empowered women, but it just made gender roles seem a little bit obsolete because Xena was so great, and she fought for good and stuck up for the little person, but, you know, she didn't always fight against men. Sometimes she's against women, evil presences. And I was just really happy that my daughters got to grow up with that.
Margaret, thanks a lot.
It could have been a little bit of a cheesy show. It was wonderful in so many ways.
Margaret, thank you for sharing that. And Margaret's story there, a testament spring to the influence that a TV show can have on the way we think creatively and maybe also the way we think about gender.
Oh, absolutely. And the 90s were quite important for me growing up or coming of age. And actually, this fall, I'm fortunate enough to be teaching a class that's going to take a deep dive into 90s girl media and culture. And Xena was an absolutely important cultural moment in terms of this depiction of this woman, but how inspiring, again, and how important it is for girls to be able to turn on a screen and see a character that can be a role model for them, that they can emulate and be inspired by and, you know, maybe not hurt each other if they're sisters and making weapons, but what it does is, to the point about making gender seem obsolete, what we begin to grapple with is the fact that in many ways these good versus evil hero tales can be genderless or gender neutral. They can be, those roles can be performed by men or women, boys or girls. We don't necessarily need to categorize them. They can become more universal.
Do you think that, are you seeing women of color getting in on this renaissance for women's roles, or is it still an imbalance toward white women?
There is still an imbalance, and we see that, again, as I mentioned, with the discussions around diversity in Hollywood, around the controversy of hashtag #OscarsSoWhite, that there is much work to be done in terms of racial diversity, ethnicity, and so forth. There was just another controversy around pay equity in terms of race. So
Hawaii 5-0, yeah.
Yes, Hawaii 5-0, the two stars, two of the stars of that show. So there is absolutely improvements to be made in terms of race and ethnicity. And that is something that doesn't need to be obscured when we're talking about gender. You make an excellent point.
So things are changing, and we're hearing about it and seeing it on screens big and small. What do you think the blue sky is here? What would you like to see when maybe we've completed a turn toward gender equity in film and entertainment?
So really the goal, not to put us both out of business, but the goal is that we wouldn't be having this conversation, that it would be so normalized and so common to see greater diversity in terms of women and girls, in terms of race and ethnicity and so on, that we don't have to talk about it as being a novelty, as being a new trend. And so hopefully as we see these films become films and television become incredibly successful, a huge blockbuster for Wonder Woman, very profitable franchise for Hunger Games, Stranger Things being award-winning and so on. Hopefully, as it makes more and more business sense, studios will continue in this direction because audiences flock to diverse representations, and we've seen audiences really clamor for this, and now that they're getting what they've wanted, we're seeing it become more successful.
Well, Spring, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Spring Duval, Assistant Professor of Communication at Salem College, joining us to talk about the shift for girls to be heroes in stories on TV and in film. Today is a special day. It's August 29th, the birthday anniversary of Michael Jackson. The King of Pop would have been 59 years old today. If you were a kid in the 80s, there's probably a little part of your soul imprinted with the music from the album Thriller. So many great songs on that album. There was this one, there was Billie Jean and Human Nature.
And there are a lot of tributes out there today to Michael Jackson, including tweets from Justin Bieber, Naomi Campbell, and Michael Jackson's daughter, Paris Jackson, who had a long, beautiful message to her father, ending with the words, "Thank you for the magic forever and always." Well, what about you? Do you have a favorite Michael Jackson song, maybe one that's especially magical to you, or a favorite memory involving the music of Michael Jackson? You can tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Side.